We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess, Chess Books Recaptured. In case you haven't heard one of these yet, this is a monthly recap of a chess book. Often it's a famous or quite notable chess book. We talk about things you can learn from the book, favorite quotes, favorite chess games, a little bit about the authors, the historical context, all that stuff. And we'll be doing that again here for August of 2020. And this month, on the heels of one of the most famous chess books of all time, My 60 Memorable Games by Bobby Fischer, last month with FM Donny Ariel, this month we're going to do something different. We're going to do the book called Blindfold Chess: History, Psychology, Techniques, Champions, World Records, and Important Games by Elliot Hurst and John Knott. It was the idea of our guest host, Jerry Wells. So without further ado, let's bring Jerry in to tell us a bit about himself and about what interested him in Blindfold Chess, the book and the concept.
Well, hi, thank you for having me. I am a fourth grade teacher. My background is in creative writing and psychology. So this is how you get to be the primary school teacher, is you study a little of everything, you work retail for several years, and then here we are. I picked up chess in my 20s. I learned how to play when I was a kid, but growing up in Appalachia, you don't really come across many chess clubs. And so I never really took it that seriously. I played some blitz. I started coaching a high school club just a few years back and realized that even though I could beat them, I couldn't really talk chess with them. I didn't know the squares. I didn't know how to, I mean, I knew algebraic notation, but I couldn't really convey to them, make this move on the board. And it really bothered me that I couldn't do that. So I went on this deep dive of how do you have the chessboard in your head? I wanted to have that. I heard stronger players at tournaments who could talk the game through. They would analyze after the game. And I didn't have any of this. So I found this book, Blindfold Chess, in the midst of that deep dive where I was trying to figure out, like, okay, I clearly have some moderate class level skills and a big weakness. And this was a book that, although it didn't give me necessarily every technique that I needed to be able to play blindfold, it gave me a sense of just how big this part of chess is. And it did lead me to some techniques that that helps me with my over the board chess and that helped me to play blindfold. I was a 1300 USCF at the time that I picked this stuff up, and I was not able to play a coherent blindfold game. And now I'm at a point where when I visit my family, we do a two board over the board blindfold simul, because that's how we can play now. And the blindfold part isn't that bad. I play blindfold leagues online. The Leech S45 league has a blindfold league, and I tend to perform better there than I do in the sighted league. And I was listening to your recent interview with Naroditsky, and he said that for Bullet at this point, he needs to improve at classical chess. And my blindfold is kind of at that level that, so I'm a 1600 USCF now, and the sort of mistakes I make in long time control blindfold are the sort of mistakes that lead me to still be a 1600 USCF. So I feel like even though I'm sort of an off the couch amateur in some ways, I have some experience to share. And this book is, it's a lot to handle, and
yeah,
and it is unsatisfying in some ways and surprisingly satisfying in other ways that I didn't expect. It's this who's who of the chess world, looking at all of these players from before Philidor up to the modern day through this lens of blindfold simuls, specifically the multi-board exhibitions. And so in here you have biographies of these players, you have little quips about the sort of people they were, you have summaries of the psychological research, you have the reflections and quotations on how to handle simultaneous exhibitions, and you have a lot of annotated games as well. There's, I forget the exact number, some 400 annotated games in here that one could really comb through and get a sense of how blindfold play has evolved over time and how players have handled it. So it's not necessarily everything you would want in a blindfold chess book, but I think if you're looking at a scholarly text, it's really a pretty comprehensive look at all of the scholarly work that's out there on blindfold.
Well said, Jerry. Yeah, there's just, and it makes sense that it's a scholarly work because it's written by a psychology professor and a British barrister who is also an author. So we'll talk more about the authors in a little bit, but it makes sense why it has this sort of academic bent. But I am glad, Jerry, that you suggested the book. Like you say, it's not a breezy read. So I will say, listeners, I mean, if you're interested in the history of blindfold chess, you will learn a ton from the book, and this is the comprehensive book. So it's got that going for it, but it's not an easy read. And the other thing is, if you're looking for something that will help your blindfold play, there's little nuggets kind of sprinkled throughout. But this isn't, as Jerry sort of alluded to, this is not necessarily the place to go. But we have good news for you guys. We also tried to compile some other resources and some tips from people who've studied blindfold chess on their own. And we'll be adding that towards the end of the podcast. And of course, there'll be a timestamp for it in the show description if you're most interested in upping your own blindfold skills as Jerry has. But Jerry, I got to say, it's pretty impressive that you're able to do two games at once. My history with this book is I had not read it previously. My history with blindfold chess, even though I made USCF Master when I was 18, I hardly ever played then. And I didn't have one of these like Russian coaches who was like, you know, the Pandolfini scene in Searching for Bobby Fischer, where this is a dated reference, but I think a lot of chess fans know, where he pulls the board out from under the pieces in anger and says, you know, you have to solve it blindfold. I didn't have that growing up. I didn't play a ton of blindfold, but once I got to college, I had a few friends who played chess, and I may have played a few drunken blindfold games in my life. That was about the extent of my blindfold chess abilities. And I have actually never even tried to play two games at once. So who knows, Jerry? I'm not going to venture to play you in blindfold, but I'm not so sure what the result would be if it happened. I had big plans when we started this that, okay, I'm going to read the book and I'm also going to try and dig in, because of course, like every other chess player, I'd like to improve my visualization. So I wanted to try some of the techniques, and I do, as is discussed in this book, and as I'm sure we'll be getting into, I mean, the overlap between just improving your visualization and blindfold is quite a lot. So I figured by doing that, I would probably become better at visualizing generally. But little did I know that Jerry had picked a book that took a lot of work. So I didn't get to the many of the games, as we'll talk about, and I didn't get to really fine tune my blindfold game, but I did distill the advice of people who've done so. So that's just some of the things that we'll be getting into. Anything to add, Jerry?
Well, we've set some homework for ourselves, I think, with the list at the end. Some homework for ourselves and for the listener. We'll keep
Yeah, exactly. And there are good resources. I mean, I have to say, this is the definitive book on blindfold simuls, but the definitive book on how to get good at blindfold chess still needs to be written. There's bits and pieces from many places. Jerry and I are both members of the Twitter chess community, where Say Chess, Martin is working on a blindfold study book for the club player. We're looking forward to him coming out with that. But there's still drips and drabs, but no sort of the complete idiot's guide to blindfold chess, which is kind of what would help a lot of people, I think. So to get into the authors a little bit more, Elliot Hurst is kind of, I believe, the stronger player. I actually don't know much about John Knott's chess history, but Elliot Hurst was super strong. I mean, he was over 2,400 USCF back when that was probably currently 2,500 USCF, and he focused on his academic career fairly young. Just to give you a sense of how strong he was, he beat Bobby Fischer when he was 13, three rounds after Bobby Fischer's Game of the Century, even though he was quite successful outside of chess in his career in academia. He's stayed involved in chess throughout his life. He had a column called Chess Kaleidoscope that appeared in Chess Life magazine. He did a bit of blindfold chess, three board simuls, stuff like that. Retired in 96. And the book came out in 2009. And this was a lifelong sort of interest of his. So I think one can pursue that he and his co-author John Knott spent a lot of time on this book. John Knott, I don't know as much about, but he's a British barrister and author, and he spent decades writing this, working on this. And they kind of both were interested in the topic independently and then realized that they should collaborate. So we are glad they did. And Jerry, which book, what version of the book did you use? I mean, I don't think there's too many out there.
I have a big chunk of a paperback. I honestly, I'm not sure if, are there other editions? I'm not actually sure.
There is an original hardcover that I just recently discovered that I think we have the same version. It's from McFarland Publishing, who are known for high quality books, sort of deeply researched books, but they tend to be on the pricey side. This one is no exception. I think I paid $40 for mine. Honestly, it's well worth it. I mean, if you're interested in the topic, it's well worth it. And if you listen to this podcast, I think you'll know if you're going to like the book or not. But Jerry, did you find it to be a worthwhile purchase?
Yes. I mean, like I said, it was what spurred me toward a lot of what I was looking for. I mean, as we'll get to later, there's Reddy and Koltanowski specifically gave advice that I found crucial, and that led me to look them up. And then looking them up led me to some of the other resources that we'll share later.
Yeah, Richard Reddy and George Koltanowski being two of the best blindfold players of all time on a short list. We'll be getting into who else is on that list in short order. So I think we're going to get right into the book, because we want to talk about the book, but we also want to leave some time to share some blindfold playing tips. So, but before we do that, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our friends at Chessable. So if you're looking for a way to improve your blindfold / visualization skills, then of course Chessable.com has something for you. Benedictine has a 5-part course called Visualize, and what they do is they show you a position, and then they tell you a few moves that happen, and then you solve a puzzle from the position after the few moves they've told you. So it's a great way to learn visualization, and it's basically the same mechanism as studying a blindfold position. So great for your visualization skills. And again, there's 5 different volumes. It can keep you busy for a long time. Lots of different levels, lots of different moves. One of the many great courses using Chessable's Move Trainer technology. So go to the website and have a look if you haven't already. Back to the podcast. And we are back, and we are going to dive right into the book. So we're going to read the first 2 paragraphs of the book from the preface. And Jerry, are you ready to take it away?
Yes, sir. The ability to play chess without sight of the chessboard or pieces is a notable achievement of human memory and imagination. It becomes even more impressive when the player conducts 10 or more such blindfold games simultaneously against opponents who do have real chessboards and pieces in front of them. When Philidor played two blindfold games at once in the 18th century, eyewitnesses were asked to swear affidavits attesting to this remarkable accomplishment. After such a performance in London in 1782, the world called it a phenomenon in the history of man and added that the feat should be hoarded among the best examples of human memory till memory should be no more. But 150 years later, Alekhine successfully played 32 blindfold games simultaneously, and newspapers described the performance as surely reaching the limits of the possibilities of the human mind and human memory in this field. However, beyond the limit, there can be nothing but chaos and madness begins. However, Alekhine's record has been broken more than once since then. Despite the lack of restraint in these journalistic evaluations and predictions, such exploits have certainly created great interest among chess players, as well as others who became aware of them, like Alfred Binet, the great psychologist who wrote a book on simultaneous blindfold exhibitions more than 100 years ago, to which we will often refer. But no book has ever been published that tries to analyze in detail the history and psychological significance of blindfold chess, and that supplies a very large number of the most important, newsworthy, and interesting games played without sight of the board, some flawless gems, and others not. Our hope is to fill that gap in the literature.
Yes, and did they ever fill that gap?
A bit.
Yeah, with quite a comprehensive undertaking. But, I mean, and as Jerry mentioned at the top, it's really, they call it the history of blindfold chess, but more than anything, it's a history of blindfold simuls. Which I do find to be a fascinating topic, and that's the primary focus, but they also kind of branch out a little bit to various topics. Like it's a three-part book. The first part is just the history of blindfold chess. The second part is the psychology of blindfold chess, which includes some research on general chess skills and studies on blindfold chess. And then the third part is blindfold chess games. But the first part is almost, it's like reading, I mean, Jerry, as a teacher, probably is more like, might remember this literature better than I, but like, it's really kind of like a linear narrative of the history of blindfold chess. I mean, they just go into blindfold simuls, so many details. I believe Pillsbury was one of the first to do them, just as a way to raise money. And of course, back longer ago, they had a sort of bigger role in the chess world, I think, because partially, it may have just, despite what we're going to talk about some people thinking it might make you crazy, they also were a way to raise money for chess players. And I think that people just might have respected it a little more, or been a little more wowed for it, or been a little more desperate to be entertained than we are today in our ages of smartphones and infinite content. But for some reason, there, with shout out to Timur Gureyev, who of course we'll be talking about, But it's not the same as it used to be. Andy Soltis describes blindfold simuls as the single most dramatic way to attract attention in chess. And there's a few other quotes like that that I enjoyed. What do you, Jerry, are you a fan of sort of the mystique as of blindfold simuls now that you've done two boards at the same time yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the idea of blindfold. Honestly, the idea of visualizing a combination was magical to me. I mean, I picked chess back up after I learned the rules as a kid. And so the idea that I could hold in my head anything basically seemed like magic to me, and still kind of does. Like there's a lot of this that is easily acquirable by most people, I would argue. And I think even some of the more advanced blindfold techniques, like I don't think two boards is beyond most chess players. I don't think that I'm an exception here. I think it's just a matter of building those specific skills. But it just having this in your head is kind of, I mean, maybe Shogi and Go have a similar possibility, but if I was a basketball player, which I'm decidedly not, there's no corollary there. There are not many things that you can remove all the toys, all the moving pieces, and still play it. And that's pretty wild to me still.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it also, it sort of drove home that all of these chess players that you read about in the history books are, for the most part, kind of singular geniuses for their time, you know? Because, I mean, of course, chess has evolved. Someone like Galyukin, like his games, you can compare with anyone from any era, but that's not necessarily true of every grandmaster. But as you go back and, or not grandmaster, but top player through history, especially as you go farther back, but the fact that they were able to play this, like just the volume of games is amazing. And it's just a cool trick. I mean, I think I've mentioned in the podcast in the past, like SIMOs are cool. It's a good way to engage a number of chess players in an event when you play like 20 people at once and walk around the room. You know, it's a nice way for everyone to engage with a famous chess player and everyone to have their shot. But any serious chess player knows that it's not that difficult unless you're playing like really strong players. Relative to your strength, it's not that difficult to do well. And blindfold, as Jerry was saying, like, you know, if you reach a certain rating, whenever you calculate, you're doing some version of blindfold. So it's harder for some people than others. I think it's certainly harder when you pick up chess as an adult, but to me, it's not unfathomable. But what these guys are doing with 20, 25, you know, now Gureyev, I should know this from working on this, what his exact record is, but whatever, 50 people or whatever it is at once, it just boggles the mind. I just can't even imagine keeping that all of that in your head. So of course it's a good way to promote chess, and of course it's worthy of being properly memorialized as it is in this book.
Yeah, the two boards is one thing. This is a human number to me.
Right.
48 maybe is Gureyev's. I'm not certain of the number either. But that is, memory does come into play. And I think one of the themes of this book is that memory is related in strange ways throughout here. But it's certainly some of the quotes, I mean, about Philidor, everyone being very sort of bowled over by his accomplishment. I mean, I feel that way about Gureyev for sure.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously a super genius. Yeah. And I mean, since his name has already come up a couple times, we might as well, for people wondering. So one thing about this book is they really trace, I mean, okay, it's like this person was good at blindfold. This person was good at blindfold. This person, you know, played this many games. This person played this many, but it's kind of hard to judge a record because are you judging like who performed the most difficult feat, meaning beat the most strongest players, or who just played the most people? And like, where does your score against the opponents come into play? So all of these questions are a little bit tricky, but Gureyev certainly broke the record for playing the most number of people. That happened in 2016. And for listeners who, I mean, a lot of people will have heard about the Blindfold King, as he's nicknamed. He was on Perpetual Chess not that long after he broke the record, by the way, in early days of Perpetual Chess, episode 20, April 2017. But John Knott, the co-author, wrote a little evaluation of Gureyev's performance. And he, of course, evaluates everyone else's performance, he and his co-author Elliot Hurst, who since has passed away, in the course of the book. But I mean, and you can read that for free on their website, which we'll link to, independent of reading this long book. But the upshot of what he says is Gureyev is now the world record holder. There'd been many others along the way, a couple of whom we'll name, some of whom we won't get to. But he doesn't consider what Gureyev did to be the most impressive blindfold feat of all time. They consider Galyukin to be the greatest of the GOAT blindfold player. And they don't think Gureyev, there was a few things where he had a bunch of like 8 to 12 move games. And, you know, you're supposed to be pretty meticulous, especially in the modern age, in terms of recording what happens with these so that it can be vetted later. And it seems like, you know, shout out to Jennifer Valens and Jay Stallings, friends of the chess community who were involved in organizing this. But in terms of evaluating it, they found it kind of tough to compare. So they don't quite put Gureyev in the number one spot. But as Jerry and I have been saying, anyone who can do this stuff it's just mind-boggling. And they name only about 50, they say at some point in the book, I mean, again, the book came out in 2009, but they say perhaps 15 people throughout history have demonstrated the ability to play 20 plus blindfold games simultaneously. Jerry, did you have like a favorite player from their descriptions?
Yes, there were some that were really endearing to me, even though they weren't necessarily the best. Just to circle back to Gureyev for a second, I think a helpful distinction when I was wrestling with this is that the most games record for blindfold simultaneous exhibitions is one distinction, one title, I guess, and the other is best blindfold simul player. And I think they make a good case because Gureyev clearly has the former, and I think they make a good case for Alekhine. I'm going to stick by my awkward anglicized pronunciation of him being the number one there. But it gets really difficult, and it's difficult to parse even how to sort out these players, because they also mention Pillsbury in this conversation, and Pillsbury's main claim was a simultaneous exhibition that he played against first category players, and he scored somewhere around 40% in this exhibition. But it was in terms of the opposition that he faced and the difficulty that he was under during the games, I mean, he didn't have any 10 move draws in there, but his score was bad. So maybe someone smarter than me could come up with some sort of algorithm where we put in strength of opposition and some factor for how often the teller winked at the player. Right. I'm not sure. But to the ones that were my favorite, Pillsbury was one of the earlier ones that really took my imagination. Because he combined he would have these blindfold simuls and he would just be doing other things because blindfold chess isn't enough. Right. He would memorize all of these multisyllabic words that I'm not going to say on a podcast, and just strings of them backwards and forward and repeat them at random times. And he would play card games, and like he clearly did not have enough to do. And he clearly had a prodigious memory outside of chess, which as we get to the other players, I think we'll find is often not the case. But Pillsbury was a strong player, was strong in a lot of things. It's from what the authors could glean, he spent some time on mnemonic devices to memorize other things. So he really stood out for me as maybe the first one, is not too brazen a claim, who approached it in kind of a methodical way. Scientific is maybe not quite the right word, but he was very purposeful in pushing the limits on this.
Yeah, and he's actually, John, not when he, one cool thing about these authors, because it's just so much information, it's tough to digest. And if, as Jerry says, if you're not going to go through the games yourself, which with a fine-tooth comb, which I'm not, it's honestly hard. Like later we'll get to a Patreon question about who the best player was, like, who do I think it was? And like, I couldn't say, you know, even having read the book. But Knott says Aljechin number one and Pillsbury number two. And getting back to what you mentioned, Jerry, about someone doing sort of a proper study of evaluating the quality of the games, like using like chess.com's cap score or whatever it may be. Friend of the podcast, frequent visitor and guest of the podcast, Christopher Chabri, and cognitive scientist. It's I was chatting with him, and he actually was friendly with Elliot Hirst before he passed away, and they actually collaborated on a study of the games in Monaco, the famous blindfold chess tournament that we'll be discussing in due time. So Chris is one of these people who obviously has the ability to do a sort of comprehensive study evaluating the quality, but stuff like that is just such an undertaking. Like just reading this book, I mean, the amount of years and effort they must have spent writing this book compared to the number of copies that it sold is, it's really a great service to the chess community.
that they did this, but there's more that could be done along those lines. But it's a tough ask of anyone to sort of do a study like that. But it would be interesting to know.
Yes, and you, I think, did some recent work for us to get Christopher Chabria on the case. And we need, I don't know if this is a sink filled job or what, we need some money poured in here.
Yeah, exactly. That's the missing ingredient. Chris is a busy guy, and his services are in demand. So we need someone to underwrite this, and then we'd be in business. But it would be interesting. And again, we're not going to go through like this person had the record and then this person had the record for most blindfold games at once. It's just too much to go through in what's already going to be a long podcast. But I did just want to sort of just give a shout out to the people that they name as the sort of some of the most, the best blindfold simul players of all time. So there's Philidor, Kizaretsky, Paulson, Morphy, Blackburn, Zuckertot, and then they get to sort of the heavy hitters like Richard Reddy and Alekhine and Pillsbury and Nydorf. And people like Karpov and Kasparov, you'd be surprised. I mean, their names make appearances, but that's around the time when blindfold simuls seem to sort of lose their luster a little bit. I mean, Kasparov did one of fewer than 10 boards. Anyone who's seen the movie Magnus has seen that Magnus was doing it when he did a couple when he's a teenager. But that now that like there's easier ways for chess players to make money, you just don't see it very often.
It's just not what's hot anymore. If you want to do something that gets you noticed, like the sexy thing is to have a Twitch channel.
Right.
You don't have to, and blindfold simuls are a lot of work. So it really takes a dedicated person like Gureyev these days to push the envelope.
Yeah, Gureyev, dedicated person, great guy, but also like moves to the beat of his own drummer, you could say. So
indeed.
So I mean, it's fitting, you know, that he's like a free spirit and views things in a different way. So he's amazing what he's doing with the blindfold simuls. And, you know, he's willing to travel the world and do them for any chess club who will have him, which is also amazing. But not everyone, you know, if you think of like Patrick Wolf, when I interviewed him talking about how he didn't really want to travel to be a professional chess player. And as Jerry says, now with the opportunities available on Twitch and now even just online tournaments, I mean, of course, we're only talking about the very top players who can sort of support themselves or the most charismatic streamers or whatever it may be. But still, there's other ways. And even just teaching from the comfort of your home, teaching online lessons as compared to torturing yourself with 25 games and, you know, possibly driving yourself crazy, it can sound appealing. So what do you think? Let's tackle this drive yourself crazy angle. We might as well dig in, okay. Jerry. So where to begin?
Well, the first question is to ask whether or not one is already crazy for playing this game.
Right. Yes. A very valid question.
This is not Fisher blaming. This is chess itself is an interesting undertaking, and blindfold perhaps doubly so. I think the place to start in some seriousness is the historical take on this. I mean, I think people kind of assumed if you're exerting yourself, you're depleting yourself of something that you might need later. And that it might overtax. There's a phrase somewhere that someone, one of these players eventually died from overtaxing of the memory cells, which probably doesn't bear. I don't know if this is the the pseudoscience corner. I think it might be. But I thought it was really interesting that there was that thread early. And Pillsbury's death was partially blamed on his blindfold exploits. But if we look a little closer with Pillsbury specifically, unless blindfold play is a cause of syphilis, this is probably not what's going on with Pillsbury. But I think he is kind of the main source of a lot of the later, all the quotes about him are a source of the later talk that maybe still persists to some extent about blindfold health.
Yeah, I mean, even Kasparov at some point when he was asked why he didn't do more of them, he alluded to it. And it seems like, especially in the Soviet Union, there was sort of a received wisdom like, yeah, you can do blindfold simuls, but be careful, man. You know, you're going to go crazy eventually. And it just seems crazy. And I mean, to the author's great credit, they kind of they try to look at it as objectively and in as detailed a fashion as they can. They kind of name all the blindfold champions and especially the ones who died like young, and they kind of break down the cause of their dying. And basically they conclude that there's no real evidence that playing a lot of blindfold simuls makes you crazy, which of course calls to mind the famous chess quote, does playing chess make sane people crazy, or does it keep crazy people sane? It's a question that's up for debate, but I don't think there's much evidence. And of course they cite the ultimate counterexample in blindfold legend Koltanowski, yes, who we'll be talking more about in a bit, but he lived to be like 96 or something. Again, I should have that at my fingertip, but he lived a very long time. By the way, it was 48 boards for Gureyev. But he lived an incredibly long, healthy life. So, and he was, you know, famous for these night tours where, I mean, among other blindfold feats, but one of his, most well-known quote-unquote parlor tricks was the famous night tour where, without looking at a board, you start the night on H1 and then you touch every square without hitting the same one twice. And there's little twists you can add to make it even more impressive. But so there's counter examples too that suggest that it doesn't really make you crazy.
Well, and the fallback to all of this, what has to be the reputation is that blindfold is exactly the same muscles as calculation. And so, I mean, it really is just an argument at the base of, well, it must be chess that's at fault, even though no one is saying that. Like it just doesn't make logical sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. So they just miss it. And I think we can move on. A couple other people of note, I believe I mentioned Neidorf, who was one of the best ever at blindfold chess. Ken Rogoff, whose name came up in my interview with Patrick Wolf. He's, of course, he's an economics professor, I believe, at Harvard. He's also a grandmaster. So incredibly strong player, but he's one of these people who really left the chess world. I mean, he doesn't seem to still have his toe in the water as far as I can tell. But just as a teenager in Long Island, he started just kind of by accident doing these blindfold simuls and having amazing results. They kind of talk a little bit wistfully about the Polgar sisters because their father, of course, whose books have been recommended often on this show, and I'm a fan of some of these books myself, they did a lot of blindfold training, and there are pictures in Judith's books of her doing blindfold training as a young girl, but they never did a big simul event. So, and again, I don't think it's because they didn't have the ability. I think it would have been kind of child's play for them, but it just shows, yes, that not as popular as it used to be. So we can't cover this whole book, but Jerry, we really can't, but Jerry did highlight a few of his favorite biographical sections. So Jerry, you ready to expound a little bit on anything that we haven't touched yet in that category?
We talked about Pillsbury and Koltanowski. I think we are about to get to in a little more depth. That was one that was really the most endearing just from this who is this person standpoint. And Neidorf was really the other one who I think also comes up in a little bit, but his story was really captivating to me. I mean, there's the story of the blindfold exhibition itself, which is it's a lot to take in. I mean, he was stranded in another country in wartime, and this was his way to get a message home. If you do a big enough blindfold simul, the papers will cover it and people will know I'm okay. Like that's pretty far removed from my personal experience as to how life goes. And I thought I guess that's what you do. And Neidorf, they talked about just how, effusive he was with chess and with people. And I always find those examples of people who are not just extraordinarily gifted, but also extraordinarily generous. That gives me some hope just about humanity. Maybe right. other people don't need a regular inoculation of how people are, but I seem to require this sort of thing. And I found that to be a major perk of the book, that we just have these quirky, half-formed sometimes, or fully formed and fully cognizant, fully humorous people, just to populate your personal mythology.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, we all need comfort in 2020. That's yeah. for sure. And yeah, Neidorf, an amazing story. I mean, of course he got, as Jerry said, stranded in Argentina and built a life there. I mean, ended up becoming quite successfully professionally, but always was super involved in chess. One quote that I actually tweeted this out when I was reading it, just because I thought it was pretty cool. He became kind of a big shot, both obviously in the chess world, but just generally. So it says, Neidorf was proud of the fact that he played chess with some famous world leaders, including Fidel Castro, Winston Churchill, Che Guevara, Nikita Khrushchev, the Shah of Iran, and Argentinian President Juan Perón, where he lived. He exchanged correspondence with Pope John Paul II, who was also a chess enthusiast. And in his Buenos Aires chess column, he published a problem composed by the pontiff. So when I tweeted it, I said that it sounded like Neidorf would have been the best perpetual chess guest ever. Yes. It's really would have been a lot of fun to hear his stories. I know when I interviewed Robert Hungosky, who's lived in Argentina mm-hmm. at times, he had some positive memories of meeting Neidorf. And that sort of segues into Koltanowski. I'm going to go ahead and read a question from longtime friend of the podcast, Peter Newhall, who's from Minnesota, and had some, he actually knew Koltanowski a little bit. So he wanted us to just discuss him a little bit. So here's Peter's question. He says, where do you put Koltanowski in the pantheon of blindfold chess players? He firmly believed he held the record for most games played simultaneously and that Neidorf's record was bogus. If I remember correctly, this was covered in the book and it seems that the record may be legit. So does that leave him third, second due to the rest of his blindfold career? What do you think, Jerry?
Koltanowski is a real character. As I was reading about him, some of the tales about him put me in mind of Faulkner, who has there's a quote here from Hans Reis, he had a cavalier attitude with facts, said right. about Koltanowski, and this is a truth of Faulkner as well, and to the point where he would in different places cite different scores for his simuls, surely something one would write down and reference. And so there's a context here where Koltanowski, that it seems like there was a misunderstanding with this Neidorf simul. So Neidorf had broken the record that had been put out there. This was his big simultaneous exhibition that he put on to get himself noticed and get the papers out. And there was a rumor that went around that Neidorf had the game scores in front of him. And this is what Koltanowski was so upset about, because if Neidorf had the game scores in front of him, Koltanowski's record stands, in my opinion. But the authors got in touch with, and forgive my pronunciation, Eliascasis. Do you have a better take on that or a different one?
I do not. I'll just throw in it was GM Eric Eliascasis, but I don't, that's the best I can do as
okay.
well.
All right.
But
go on. We'll assume that's wrong and enjoy it.
Right. On brand.
So he shared a letter with them. He sent them a letter. He was at Neidorf's exhibition, and he sent these newspaper articles that basically put Neidorf in the clear. There's no evidence to suggest really that this had happened, but instead that they were. There seems to be, like, somebody said that he had the game scores, and then that was like he was in possession of them in real life afterward, and that had been mistranslated. Was that?
Yeah. So apparently, like, I think it might have been actually firsthand. Like, Koltanowski at some point asked Neidorf, like, "Do you have the game scores, or did you have the game scores?" And he said yes, but he didn't mean he was looking at them, like, at the time he was playing them. And Koltanowski, I mean, this was his livelihood. So, I mean, I think it behooved him to continue to be the record holder. So when he heard that, he made a point of saying, like, that's not legitimate, which of course it's not, as Jerry said. Like, if you're playing 50 games and you get to read through the moves of each game as you're going, like, I might be able to do that, you know. I can't play like Koltanowski, but I can at least, like, make a move, you know, if you give me enough time and give me the score sheet. So obviously it's a big difference, but their final answer, and, you know, again, nobody's perfect, but when you read this book, it's hard to cast aspersions on the amount of rigor that these authors put into answering these questions. And their final answer is that Neidorf was the one who had the record, not Koltanowski. Of course, that doesn't lessen Koltanowski's legacy in any way. And as to Peter's question about where he ranks in the pantheon, I mean, honestly, Peter, I really am not qualified to answer. They do have 400 blindfold games or something like it in the game section, but I started this book plenty in advance of recording this podcast, but going through the games, it was just too much. And even if I did, I don't really feel like I'd be, like, a great judge of who the best player was. So, I mean, I think we just have to defer to the authors.
Well, as someone who is also unqualified to answer that question, I would like to provide an answer.
Okay.
I think that Koltanowski has a special place in the pantheon of blindfold chess players because he was one of these oddities who felt or seemed to feel more comfortable without the pieces in front of him. This is one of the things that really endeared him to me, is that he just didn't really seem to want to deal with the wooden pieces in front of him. And it was tedious to him. It's kind of the impression that I got, but he played more creatively. He played more concretely. He paid attention, but you have to pay attention the whole time in a simul, to keep things from falling out of your head. And I think that makes him special. And I did go through several of his games, just in full transparency. I left most of the games sort of unscoured. It's a lot. There's a lot here. You're getting your money's worth. But Koltanowski had a lot of short draws in his exhibition, and even it was pretty clear that he was trying to reduce the number of games early, and that's fine. I mean, I can't blame him for it, but I think it does begin to show a difference between his performance and Neidorf's, where Neidorf's games were played to their conclusions. But that's one of my favorite games from the book, was a Koltanowski one, which I think it wasn't a scintillating brilliancy necessarily, but it gives a flavor of what this book can give you, is a Max Lange attack against a Scottish youth champion, and just all the details they put in these annotations about who these people were and what openings they tended to play. You can really dig in this for a very long time and find interesting facts about people and really expand your horizons on who is interesting in chess. I think that maybe Koltanowski isn't really in the top three in terms of full blindfold players. He was a record holder at a certain point of the most games, and maybe he is in the conversation of best blindfold player, but I think perhaps because he wasn't one of the top classical players, I think the quality of his games, and again, I don't have the cap scores, I don't have the algorithm, but from my eyeballs, I don't know that the quality of his games is quite at the level of Neidorf and Alekhine.
Yeah, and those two obviously are giants of the game. Koltanowski, amazing player, but he was an IM. He never made GM title. Of course, a lot of people point to how much blindfold stuff he did as the reason he never got. I mean, he actually got the honorary GM title later in life, but he never over the board got the GM title. But I mean, I think it really was because he kind of latched on to this blindfold sort of side hustle, and ended up just doing it a ton and making a you know, having tons of tremendous accomplishments. Obviously, any conversation about the history of Blindfold Simuls and sort of Blindfold Chess Feats, his name is going to come up. So that's all. That's what we got for you, Peter. But thank you for the great question. Couple more things on the book before we get to just some blindfold tips. Part two is really cool. Part two, so it's kind of, they kind of take a turn and they stop from the blindfold history and they just kind of go through a history of like studies of chess and the brain. And this is the section where people like Adrian de Groot get mentioned a lot. Christopher Chabris' name comes up a couple times. Studies conclude that chess skill is based on both pattern recognition and thinking ahead. Another quote, a mass of evidence indicates that chess masters as a class do not possess exceptional memories outside of chess. So all these questions that we sometimes kind of in amateurish fashion kick around on this podcast, they kind of with some rigor dig into. I mean, I found it interesting, but again, you wouldn't know from the title Blindfold Chess, like it's not a totally natural fit for the book. What did you think of the second section of the book? Jerry?
I thought it was fascinating, the things that we have pinned down in the research, and the there are things that kind of confirmed current conventional wisdom, both about blindfold and about playing. Blindfold ability is largely driven by chess ability, which isn't particularly surprising, but the study that illuminated that I found really interesting. It was a single subject study, which we're trained to sort of frown at, but they trained her to reproduce the position of a diagram really, really well. And she wasn't much of a chess player. I don't remember if she even was a chess player, but she could reproduce. They would show her a position for a little bit and then take it away and have her reproduce it. And she got much, much better at this over the course of the study. And that didn't change. That didn't magically make her a brilliant player. So there are a lot of little insights like that give some rigor to what we talk about. I think the feeling that I had leaving that section was that I would like it to go on and mm-hmm. have more, like there are things being discussed in the chess world right now that could really use some good neuroscientists. I know just enough about research methods to know that we need more research to really know. I mean, we'll be giving some tips and I believe in them. And there's kind of a buffet of things you can do. And we can kind of make some granular diagnoses, which is something, again, that Grandmaster Narodisky was talking about recently, about if this bit of your visualization is the problem, here's an exercise. And I think that's useful. But I think that my big takeaway from this is that there's been a lot of good research. There's been a lot of very competent researchers looking at this, but we don't really have all the answers yet.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I do find it super interesting, but even just reading the book, I mean, the way that science evolves, having been published in 2009, I just wondered I feel like even if I read something and they present it as sort of a settled question, I'm like, well, what have they discovered in the past 8 years? Right. You know, because then I'm going to go and spout off about it on the podcast and I'm going to find out it's wrong, you know? It's a ever evolving thing and it's a tricky subject, but certainly, as you say, the main thing is we just don't know enough. One interesting sort of sideline in part two, again, getting back to Christopher Chabris, and I think this is one of the projects that he collaborated on with Elliot Hurst, was they looked at the games from Melody Amber, this very famous blindfold tournament that I mentioned earlier that took place in Monaco every year for about 15 years, starting in 1992. Now, these were not simuls, but this was sort of a showcase event with, say 8 to 10 of the top 20 players in the world, and they would play rapid games, but they would also play blindfold rapid games. And what Chris and Elliot Hurst did in, sorry, Chris, I should know what year you did this in, but it was either the late 90s or the early 2000s, I believe. They did an early version of the CAP score, with the computers that were available at the time to sort of evaluate the quality of the play of the grandmasters playing one blindfold game. Now, grandmasters, I mean, there's been many who've said it's, you know, for a player of that caliber to play one blindfold game, it's basically the same thing as playing regular chess. Kramnik has said that. Peter Svidler and Ivanchuk, of course, are famous for like when they're calculating, not even looking at the board half the time. So it's well established that they should it shouldn't be that different. But Chris and Elliot actually provided empirical evidence that that's basically true. You might have one or two more howlers in terms of like the level of the blunder. Like you might make a blunder that you just wouldn't ever make in OCB chess. But other than that, it's the chess is just as good.
Yeah, I really like that study. I'm glad that that exists. And what the correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think one of their takeaways was that the blunders differed qualitatively, but they measured it on these multi like pawn based thresholds.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, the biggest, like the 8+ blunder, happened more often in sighted grandmaster play than in these Monaco blindfold games. Now maybe that's because of the sample that you have these really strong players coming to Monaco. I'm not sure how they did that sample, if it was the same players for both samples, but it was it kind of made sense to me that there are also certain mistakes that you don't make while you're being very careful about checking things because it's blindfold.
Yeah, that's a good point. And another thing that interested me, Jerry, was that they had pictures of them playing at Melody Amber, and I didn't realize that they have, when they did these blindfold tournaments, they were looking at a blank board. Did you know that that's how they worked at these famous tournaments?
I had heard that before, and it made me feel in my layman's way like I'm in good company. This is how the blindfold games I play online work too. You have the blank board, and I have it set up for speech, but you get your opponent's move. I think for their level it probably doesn't matter. But for the amateur kind of in my position, the class player position, and if you have tried blindfold before and have really struggled, I would encourage you to try it with the board in front of you. It's a different thing. I think it probably was just an ease for the grandmasters at Melody Amber. I think it was probably just an ease of transmitting moves. I think that was the big thing for them. I could be wrong about that. But for those of us who don't yet have a perfectly calibrated and well-oiled chess machine in our brains, I think it can be useful.
Yeah, I mean, probably it doesn't matter for them, but even for me, I mean, it helps for sure. Mm-hmm. Just to have the 64 blank squares in front of you. I mean, it's just so much easier to visualize that than the whole board, in my opinion. But yeah, it probably doesn't matter for them. I mean, certainly, you know, any grandmaster, you've seen them do like the speed which with they can like Amon Hambleton when he's doing his blindfold on the Chess Bros stream. I mean, to be able to play blindfold blitz, that's another area where I really feel like the people hundreds of points higher rated than me, it shows why, you know, like I can struggle to play a blindfold game and I can, you know, maybe put together a decent game, but it's not speedy for me.
No hyperbullet blindfold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
For me either. Don't worry.
Yeah. That's not going to be happening. So what else do we need to hit on from the book before we get on to, well, we got to hit a few quotes, I guess.
Yes.
So we'll try to keep this short and then get to some playing advice. But Jerry, what were your, and again, there's going to be little good historical nuggets in these quotes. So Jerry, what could you reel off one of your favorites?
Yes, I'm trying to prioritize and failing out loud. I think there's one, Reddy shows up twice. I think I'm going to stick with Reddy. There's Tartakover was quoted as saying, "Where Reddy's briefcase is, there he himself is no longer to be found. It is therefore evidence of Reddy's pre-existence." And the Hurst and Knott continue. Soltis's 1993 book on Marshall records that on the briefcase's return to Reddy, after he had set a new world record for the number of simultaneous blindfold games in 1925, Reddy said, "Oh, Thank you. I have such a bad memory.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of stories like that. Like they debate, do these guys, like, are they just super geniuses with photographic memories? And in some of, again, the aforementioned part too, they try to parse a little bit, like, do these people have spectacular memories? And if I recall correctly, basically the conclusion is they have great chess memories, but it doesn't necessarily correlate to other things, as shown in this quote about Richard Reddy, who of course is the author of Masters of the Chessboard and many other books. And as you say, as someone we should have mentioned, because Al-Yekin himself at the time said, we of course are the two best blindfold players in the world. So he belongs on whatever short list as well.
Yes. And that quote about them being the two best blindfold players was another little story I liked quite a lot, that because they're analyzing blindfold and they're disagreeing, like, no, this side's better. They can't agree. They say, okay, let's get out a chess set. They reanalyze exactly the same line. Don't change any of the analysis, get to the final position and continue to disagree about the evaluation. Right. So these guys don't need a board.
Yeah, exactly. Another person we haven't mentioned, but takes a reasonably prominent role in the book, is Grandmaster Ruben Fine, who also studied psychology, like the author Elliot Hurst, gave up chess kind of at the peak of his career, was one of the top, 10 players in the world, but then became interested in psychology. So they say GM Ruben Fine became interested in psychology and eventually received a PhD in the subject from USC. For the rest of his life, he devoted himself mainly to the practice of psychoanalysis in NYC. He retained a strong Freudian emphasis in his work, even after Freud's views on many matters had been rejected or radically revised by his colleagues. Psychologists who were also active chess players joked that his departure from the chess battlefield was a loss for chess and at best a draw for psychology. So I found that funny. I've seen that quote somewhere else. And there's a few quotes like that. I mean, they did an immense amount of research, so it's only natural that you're going to sort of see quotes from other resources. But that's kind of part of the appeal of the book to me, because it sort of draws a lot together. And Ruben Fine also, of course, comes up in any sort of reading about Bobby Fischer, because his mom sort of was worried that Fischer was spending too much time on chess, and like Fine was a grandmaster, but also a psychologist. So she sent him, and Fischer kind of sniffed out that he was being evaluated. And, but they nonetheless played a lot of blitz games, and Fine is someone who could actually like judge Fischer's talent and of course compete with him.
And Fine played a lot of the speed blindfold too, which is something Polgar's did and something that I find completely baffling.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he was a just singular talent in terms of blindfold chess, which, again, we don't have the science to back this up, but I mean, I feel like that says something about your overall chess ability. I mean, if you can just, like it's a joke, just play a blindfold speed chess game and, like, crush, like, masters or whatever it may be, like, that's impressive stuff.
Yeah,
I wouldn't really know. All right. You have any other quotes to throw in, Jerry?
I will keep it to one more. You'll have to buy the book to find out about Samish's pipe. This is Diderot writing to Philidor about this blindfold play. He says, "Take my advice. Write more fine music for us. Write it for many years yet. And do not expose yourself further to the possibility of being an object of scorn. At most, they will say of you, 'There is that Philidor creature. He is nothing anymore. He lost all the sense he had by pushing little pieces of wood across a chessboard.'" I just felt that was a nice heartwarming sentiment to keep us chess players to keep at heart.
Right. And there's a lot of that, especially with the older era players, which, I mean, I won't comment further on that. I'll go to another quote. This one is about Alexander Al-Yekin, and again, it's not directly related to blindfold. I just found it funny. So they tell this story. Al-Yekin, as a naturalized citizen of France, arrives at the Polish border on a journey to Warsaw to play at an international team tournament. He had no passport, but told border officials, "I am Al-Yekin, chess champion of the world. I have a cat called Chess. I do not need papers." Gotta love the humility there.
It's very good.
Yeah. Okay. So favorite games, Jerry and I both mentioned it's not a big, yeah. I mean, I just couldn't do it. I'm sorry. It was 400 games. I'm interviewing authors every week. I have other stuff to do. I have children. I'm sorry, guys. I couldn't go through the 400 games. But I still, again, I think from if you've made it this far into the podcast, you'd have a sense of whether or not you find this book interesting, and then you can take the games or you can leave them. Certainly, it doesn't diminish the task, the act of the authors of compiling all these games, especially because they were really parsing them to try to see what records were legitimate. One game that they mention as one of the most famous blindfold and most impressive blindfold games is an Alekhine game that I'll link to in the show notes. But that's about all I got on the topic of games. What about you, Jerry?
Well, I mentioned the Koltanowski game to give kind of a sample of a lot of these blindfold games are from the more romantic era of chess. And even, of course, Gureyev plays a lot of romantic style chess in his blindfold games. The only other one I wanted to mention, there's a lot that you can dig through in here. They're heavily annotated games. It's very impressive. But I'll just mention that there's a Judit and Sophia Polgar 5-minute blitz blindfold game in here, which involves Judit sacrificing on f7 in a Sicilian. So if that's your kind of thing, it's in here.
Okay, and luckily it's I believe it is either game or page 428, and according to our notes here, and Jerry, I am going to check that one out because I love big Judah fan, so I got to see that. So yeah, quibbles with the book. I mean, it's overall good. I mean, I would just say it's not a fast read is all I would say. But again, great public service. Definitely recommend it. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you would enjoy the book. Jerry, anything to add about how the book is presented or anything like that?
I think that covers it. It offers quite a lot and is unparalleled. And we have some things that we would like some talented authors to some gaps we would like them to fill in the literature.
Yeah, for sure. So we might as well talk about some other resources because, and you know, often when we do these book recaps, we say, how much will this help your chess improvement? Your actual chess, very little. Although, I mean, I guess if you play through the games, you might get something. But they do have blindfold how to play tips sprinkled throughout. And we also went to some other resources for some more. So there's a lot of talk about sort of splitting the, I mean, there's, we're going to go more granular when we get to the outside sources, but within the book, there's a, like Richard Reddy recommended splitting the board into four quadrants. He recommends practicing the color of each square. In addition, I think he was the one that told a story where like another grandmaster or another blindfold master told him that each night before he was going to bed, he would picture like an empty chessboard on the mm-hmm. ceiling of his bed and like try to play through some opening on the ceiling.
That was Chibrich, again, pronunciation optional, for talking to Koltanowski, who then tried to paint a chessboard on his ceiling.
Oh, good. And wow. Well, nice pull, Jerry. Well done.
It's so good, though, because yeah. He's standing on his bed trying to paint this chessboard on his ceiling so he can be like this. I forget where the guy's from. The pull ended there. But this master that he's seen play a simul, beating him in the simul while he was sighted, and his dad comes in and says, well, you're going to have to find another way to do this chess thing. Yes. And then he took a paper board and cut it into the four quadrants. And he also did this same thing to and he showed in his quote, he talks about how if you learn the diagonals for one quadrant, they're just duplicated. And so if you can get the geometry down of one quadrant, then you're really going to get the square colors down quickly and you're going to get the board in your head. And I did find the quadrant approach helpful to me when that was one of the things that I took away from this that I applied. Now it may have helped because I was lying there thinking, what are the quadrants? What are the diagonals? Like maybe it was that work and not the quadrant specifically that was helpful to me. But I mean, it's worth a try if you're also struggling to find the board in your head.
Yeah. And of course, people painting chessboards on their ceiling is why we have to worry about the questions about the sanity of chessboards.
It might improve many a ceiling.
Right. That's true. So a couple other quotes. Tony Miles, legendary British GM who unfortunately passed away too soon. He makes a little cameo in the book. He apparently did like one blindfold simo and basically like a mic drop. Like he'd never done it. He's just like, oh, let me try this. And he put on like a very impressive display and never did it again. But he did write about it and they quote him. They give like a lengthy quote about him. He said, and his bit of advice was the absolute, and this is for blindfold simos, so I'm guessing a lot of you won't be taking this advice, but nonetheless, he said the absolutely essential thing is to separate the positions so that they each develop their own individual character and become memorized as pictures rather than strings of details. And they also give other little tricks like, oh man, I'm also forgetting, Jerry, maybe you'll also remember who it was that had each person say the name themselves.
I think a couple of them did that. Alakon was one that they mentioned a couple times. He felt that he could keep the individual character of the game in his head better by hearing the voice. And Gureyev, I think, does that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly a good idea rather than just have one announcer say all the games, have be able to associate a voice with each thing. Miles also had a good quote, getting back to Koltanowski dying at 96 and whether or not blindfold chess drives you crazy. Miles said, Koltanowski proves that if it does drive you crazy, it does so very slowly.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Just to circle back to Ready for just a second, I just remember there was one point I wanted to make. There's an ongoing perpetual chess sort of debate about opening theory. And while I won't wade too far into it, Ready talks about his visualization, his blindfold play being aided by studying opening books. And yeah. As someone who, when I was, I went to an over the board tournament and I was just getting thrashed in the openings because I didn't know what I was doing. And I got Watson's strategic repertoire, his D4 repertoire, which I, even though I'm no longer a D4 player, is still dear to my heart. But I would go to bed with this thing, and this was my nightly reading, and I would close it and would kind of still have the lines in my head. And that was where a lot of my early visualization came from. I've talked to a couple other players who are kind of opening minded. Sorry, world, the amateur with the opening tendency, here I am. But there is some anecdotal evidence that you can, if this is your fascination, you're doing chess work there and to some degree. And I think it certainly did help me because I know the main tabias of my lines. I could visualize much else in chess.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And you can, it can help you learn blindfold. I mean, mm-hmm. because like you say, if you know a given position, that makes it easier to go one or two moves deeper. And the process of doing that, you're still going to be improving your blindfold skills. One other thing we forgot to mention, I mean, just in terms of their like tricks, all these guys who are doing like 20 to 25 boards, they all have systems for keeping the board straight, which I found interesting. Again, probably not of much practical use to the listeners, but they're doing like certain moves on like E4 on one board, D4 on the other, or they do them in chunks and just various memory tricks to help them remember. But I think of more use to our audience will be sharing general blindfold tips for those like who want to just get better. And we went through some other books as well that we can discuss briefly and some other resources where if you want to up your blindfold skills, before we let you all go, we want to reward you for listening to this whole thing with some blindfold tips. So number one, there's a classic book, Improve Your Chess Now by Grandmaster Jonathan Tisdall. It's been name checked a couple times on Perpetual Chess. It's one of my personal favorites. And he gives little blindfold quizzes in it. He has a few cool quotes. He says, here I want to discuss the major set of middle game muscles, the powers of clarity, depth, and calculation. Like any other muscle group, it can be exercised and its strength increased. In my opinion, the most reliable method to do this is by directed blindfold practice. And in the intro, even before he gets to that, I think he was about 39 when he wrote that book, somewhere in that range. He was just saying that he was starting to see his calculating deteriorate. So he started to really work on actual blindfold chess, and he saw a real difference. And he gives a bunch of sort of blindfold games, like 12-move games where it's like find the way to win a piece on move 12 and it'll be some double attack or something. So not super hard stuff, but stuff where you really have to work to keep the position, particularly like we were saying, if you don't know the opening. There's also what he calls the stepping stones technique, which where he just suggests that you anchor to a given position. So you might, like if it's a French or whatever, and you know the first five moves pretty well, once you get to the fifth move, you really try to take a picture of your mind of that position, and then you kind of build forward from there for, to the next sort of stepping stone position. So that's a that's something that was effective for him. But he generally just says that visualization and blindfold, they're kind of joined at the hip, and by working on one, you're working on the other. So definitely a book. I mean, the blindfold stuff is just part of that book, but overall a book well worth picking up, and you can find some good blindfold puzzles in there. What else, Jerry? What other resources can we recommend?
Well, I want to echo the stepping stones briefly. In my blindfold play, such as it is, that technique is how I survive, and it's why I can't play the shorter time controls yet, because I do have to, every few moves or so, kind of re-anchor where are the pieces again, and just like running my mental hand over the board to find everything again is similar to that stepping stone technique, which you can also do in your over the board calculation. If you're five moves in calculation, you could sort of stop and look around and find everything. So I just wanted to highlight that as something that I also think is very useful. The big ones for me are the ones that you can work on yourself, because a lot of us are working too much for our jobs, and we don't have much time to really devote to this to affect some 4 hours a day ready style revolution in our brain. And there are two apps that I've found that there are web versions and at least Android. I'm not sure about Apple folks here, but Noir Chess, N-O-I-R Chess, is one that I've used quite a lot. You can practice square colors. It'll put the square color up and you push light or dark. You can practice diagonals. You can practice night jumps. And it also has textual tactics, these blindfold puzzles, usually 5 to 7 pieces. And they go up in rating. So as you solve them, you get more difficult ones. But I've found those to be really helpful to sharpen my visualization, to really get it back on point, because you just have the text of the pieces in front of you and you have to fix them on your mental board. And then once you fix them, you push the button and it takes everything away and tells you what the opponent moved. And so often the position they give you is a draw, and then they take the notation away and your opponent has just played a blunder. How do you punish it? So I found that really, really useful. Another one is ChessViz. This is the other app that I lean on a lot. It has some follow the move exercises. So it'll give you some notation and it'll show you the board, and then it will take the notation away and you play the five moves or whatever. You reproduce the position at the end of the calculation. So you calculate through to the end of it, visualize it fully, and then reproduce it. And I think that's working some similar muscles. And the real kicker here, this is something that I picked up from, that I went looking for because of a series I found by Danny Rinch, his Full Board Nirvana series, which I highly recommend. I'm not sure if it's behind the paywall or not, but he talks about a lot of exercises, practicing night tours with a blank board. And he talks about these who's guarding whom exercises, which as far as I can tell is an old Soviet torture technique, which I have then passed on to some of my students. But it gives you four pieces on the board and you click these, you toggle, or you tell your coach the relationship between those pieces. So queen is guarding knight, queen is guarding bishop, bishop's guarding queen, so on. And then it tells you a move and you tell all the relationships again, and then another move, and then another move, until someone says stop or you pass out. And the fluency skill of here's all the connections between these pieces is a muscle that took me quite a lot of work to build, and is something that I know is still still a weak point in my play. If you look, analyzing my games, I can tell, especially in the shorter time controls, that I just don't know. I don't know who is attacking what sometimes. It just doesn't, right. It doesn't click in my head the way it does for a stronger player. And I think this is a really good way and a novel way, something you can add to your training repertoire to practice that.
Good stuff, Jerry. Yeah, Danny Wrench, of course, of chess.com and Noir Chess and Chess Viz. You kind of found some deep cuts there. And for anyone listening, we'll do comprehensive notes because this is a lot to take in. But I do think it's a lot to. I do think it's really good resources. Hearing you mention again, Richard Reddy, we never dove into the approach that he shared, which was in some detail. And I can't find it in my notes, but he basically at some point in the book said that he learned to play blindfold in a matter of months just by committing hours a day to it over that period. And he was someone who, as Jerry mentioned, used opening books in order to do it. But for anyone who does pick up the book or if anyone's super interested, I'm sure I can track down the quote. But basically, he started playing through games blindfold and openings that he knew for hours a day, every day. And he said, within a couple months, he just felt like he just knew how to do it. And of course, he became who Al Yekin considered the second best blindfold player in the world and someone in the top 10 of all time. Of course, it helps when you're like a GM to begin with. But
and 16 at the time.
Yeah, 16, which doesn't hurt. But that's not, that's not eight.
That's a good point. That's really true.
Not super young. A couple other resources, of course, regular listeners will have heard the Chess Step series come up very often. They don't have a ton of blindfold stuff, but they have one book that you should definitely get if you're in the, say, 1,200 to 1,600 range, something like that. It's called Thinking Ahead, Volume 2, and it's kind of all about visualization. It has everything from short games to what we call visualize exercises, which we'll be getting into briefly, to select the square color on a given square, find a safe square for a piece blindfold. So just lots and lots of sort of creative little blindfold type puzzles, including as with Tisdall, some actual just first five moves from a game, white to move and win material. They're easier than the ones that Tisdall gives. But definitely if you're in that rating range and looking to get better, it's like $10 and well worth it. Have you checked that one out, Jerry?
Yes, I'm a big fan of it. And I would expand that rating range with some caveats in both directions. I used to, maybe this, the fact that I use the who's guarding whom exercise and then this upcoming fact might tell you a little bit about how I am a scholastic coach. This was our warm-up. I would pull pages from this and they would have to solve the, especially the is this position mate puzzles quite a lot, where it would just give the position of the pieces and you have to say whether or not it's mate. I pulled from it extensively and it's a really good resource. And just on that note with the scholastic players, which I'm not even sure if I mentioned at the top that I work with scholastic players quite a lot, at least I did before the unpleasantness began. But I think that and this is something that Reddy said too, that it's really helpful to start thinking about this blindfold stuff early in the development. You don't have to necessarily be a strong player yet. For my own practice, I introduce it pretty much as soon as they can have a semi-coherent game sheet in algebraic notation. I wasn't too sure about that until we were driving back from traveling a long way to a tournament, and the middle school students sitting behind me, the two of them, both of their phones died, which means that I had trouble on my hands. And so I said, well, why don't you play blindfold? And they made mistakes, but they made it a good six or seven ply in, still playing a sane game. And then they did it again and made it farther. So this thinking at the steps method book, I think is appropriate for, especially for highly motivated people who are going to put a lot into it, even if they're not yet in that 1200 range.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's really good. To throw in another one, I'm you guys will have already heard an ad read for this. The Visualize series at Chessable, I have used this with students. It's really good. And again, some of these other resources do similar things, but basically what they do is they give you a certain position and then they tell you three more moves that happened. And then they say, okay, what's the best move in that position? And Jerry, I believe you've worked with that one too, right?
I have. I bought one and then I even got to beta test one, which was a lot of fun. And yeah, I would highly recommend those. And a similar one that came out before, this may be another kind of deep cut, it's called Chess Fox. And they have the Visualize series where you buy a PDF that has a similar thing, except instead of the notation, it shows a diagram and then it draws arrows. So you get a new diagram with a new arrow each page, and then it stops, shows the original position, and says white to move or whatever.
Yeah, you found so much stuff, Jerry. How did you find all these resources?
Obsession. It was clearly the thing that was holding me back. And I spend a decent amount of time at least looking at chess, maybe not working hard on it, but thinking about working hard on it.
Right.
And there's a decent amount out there, but there's, especially in this area, I think there's room for people to give more.
Yeah, there is. But I mean, this is a good little list. It would be great if it were in one book. And by the way, I did want to just name the author. It's Benedictine of the Visualize courses on Chessable. And one other time that blindfold chess has come up a lot in a Perpetual Chess interview was another older interview with Elliot Neff, who's mostly, he runs a very successful scholastic program in the state of Washington, and he had written a book, but I think partially because he's sort of the head of a company that does scholastic chess, and he's a master level player. He's about USCF 2300, but still, by his admission, didn't feel like he was like some big blindfold genius, but I think partially motivated by like wanting to be able to do blindfold exhibitions, wanting to be able to show off your chess skill at events and stuff like that. He's put a lot of work in, become a strong blindfold player. He talked about it in our interview, so you can dig through the archive and find that. But more to the point, he made a YouTube video where he gives sort of step-by-step analysis of like how to learn to play blindfold. And these are the steps that Elliot recommended. He says to, and by the way, this is on the Chess House, which I believe sells chess books and equipment channel. He said, but I'll link to it, of course. He says, to learn to understand the board, first learn to name the color of a square. Okay, we've talked about that before, but it's still important. Then place a piece on a square and name all the squares it attacks. That's step two. Step three, add a piece like a knight, move it around the edge of the board, then across the board. So it might be like, okay, how are you going to get a knight from A4 to H5? And then you just practice moving it in your head from A4 to H5 and then try to fact check it and see if you got it the fastest way. Playing moves in your head, similar to the Visualize course from Chessable that we mentioned. Playing a handful of moves from start to begin is step five. And then on and on from there until you're able to do a whole game. So he just goes sort of step by step and gives very sort of gradual recommendations of how to learn it. So definitely another good resource if you're sort of feel like you're starting from scratch. And I think he can do simuls now, if I'm not mistaken. Just amazing to me. It doesn't cease to be amazing to me, the blindfold simul thing. Did we get all of the resources, Jerry? There's a couple more. But
there's an endless amount. I think we have probably given them enough to start, do you think?
Well, I do want to mention this chess podcast that Geert Vandervelt linked to the other day. I don't know the person who's doing it, but it's very gracious of them. I think it's just called Blindfold Chess. It's on Spotify and the other podcast apps. But basically, as I think I might have listened to it once at some point, but then I'd forgotten about it and then Geert linked to it. But if I'm not mistaken, he's just reading off the moves of famous games. And doing it sort of in a kind of slow manner so that you can follow the game. So I apologize, I don't have all the details, but for those of you interested, I'll link to it and you can check it out. Just promise that you'll keep listening to Perpetual Chess in addition to listening to this Blindfold Chess podcast. But yeah, I think that's about it.
I think so. I think there's a lot here. There's a lot to the book. There's a lot to learn about visualization. But if you've made it this far, you surely know something by now.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least, you know, you have some idea where to start. And honestly, we could go on even more. There's tons of other stuff we highlighted. I mean, the book has a lot and there's so much stuff about blindfold chess, even beyond that. But I think that gives you guys a good overview. You know whether or not you wanted to buy the book. And if you want to get better at blindfold, hopefully we've given some good resources. And again, you'll be able to read all about it. So, Jerry, I mean, in conclusion, so we're giving this book a thumbs up, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, definitely a thumbs up. Like, if you're wholeheartedly or single-mindedly, I should say, thinking about improvement, it's not the best, but it might be like for a chess fan, it might be like some good bedtime reading sort of thing. You'll definitely learn some chess history and definitely noble task that these authors did. And Jerry, I want to thank you for taking the time to do this. I mean, obviously it's a absolutely crazy year and I know you've got the school year starting and I know that you're actually in school. Much to my dismay, if no one else's. So I appreciate you doing this. And we had just briefly talked about this month's donation. So what should we do with it, Jerry?
I've just forgotten the name of it, Ben.
It's called Books Behind Bars. So last month with Donnie Ariel, we didn't have it lined up. What chess prison charity, and I found one called Books Behind Bars. So that's where I donated Donnie's payment, and Jerry said, let's keep it rolling. And obviously, yes, we have way too many prisoners in the United States. So let's get them some chess books. So I will reach out to them again and send them some more chess books. It was kind of fun for me to pick like an unknown prisoner, try to find different books that cover different. You know, you want something like The Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess that can cover like a range of topics, but you also want something that people can dig into even more, like some games collections. So yeah, that was fun to do. And we'd be happy to make another donation for the month of August. Okay. So Jerry, thanks so much. I know you're on Twitter. If anyone else would like to praise you lavishly for the work you've done on this podcast, is there anywhere else they should reach you?
Twitter's the best place. That's at Jerry Wayne Wells. You can also, I'm on Lee Chess, which is the only chess site that I know of. Shots fired across the bow. It's JW Wells 42. And I would also, if allowed, like to give a quick shout out. I mentioned the Lee Chess 45-45 League. They have a lot going on, including a blindfold league, which I would encourage you check out, and to the Chess Lounge Discord, which is responsible for a lot of what I've learned about chess in the last couple of years. Those things are out there. There are people working to get better at chess and sharing stories like the ones we shared from this book all over the internet. So don't be shy.
Excellent. Good stuff, Jerry. And before we let Jerry go, because I know some people are going to turn this off before the blindfold puzzles, but I am doing blindfold puzzles, but I did want to let you guys know there's not going to be a book recap next month. I somehow have managed not to whine for an hour and a half about what's going on with my family attempting to buy a house and having it fall through. And now we don't know if the second one's going to fall through and all this stuff, but basically a lot going on in addition to a lot was going on even before we were moving. So I just need a month break, but I'll be excited to bring it back in October and maybe even get them out a little bit earlier in the month. If I can. So we'll be back in October, but Jerry, thank you for your contribution this month, and listeners who are interested, stay tuned for a few blindfold puzzles in the spirit of this episode. All right. Thanks again, Jerry.
Thank you so much. And good luck. Thank you for everything you do for our weird little community.
My pleasure. All right. Have a good night, Jerry.
You too.
All right, guys, I am back with three, count them, three blindfold puzzles of varying levels from different sources. Number one is from Chess Steps Thinking Ahead. This one is pretty basic, but it gives you kind of a flavor for what's in that book. It is a blindfold game from the starting position. And the question is, what is White's best move on move five after we go through the beginning? So here we go. White plays e4, black plays g6, d4, black plays bishop g7, white plays knight f3, black plays c5, white plays d5, black plays knight c6. So where should white now go? I'll give you the moves again, just rattle them off. e4, g6. 2, d4, bishop g7. 3, knight f3, c5. 4, d5, knight c6. Where should white go? Okay. Puzzle number two, significantly harder. It's one of these tricky mate in two ones. So not a lot of pieces on the board, but try to find the mate in two. This one is from Chess Steps Volume 3. It's not a blindfold puzzle, just from one of their regular puzzles. White has a pawn on a5 and a queen on h1 and a king on c5. So once again, white has a pawn on a5, a queen on h1, and a king on c5. Black's king is on a7, and it's white to move and checkmate black's king in two moves. And as always with these puzzles, guys, there will be links to the prose, the words of the puzzles in the show description, and then you can click through and actually see the position and the solution. Last but not least, an actual game from the book. This one is from Pillsbury against BVD Dixon in 1900. It is a blindfold simul, and Pillsbury actually lost. And the question is, what move did Pillsbury overlook? Get it? Overlook in a blindfold simul. So I'm going to give you guys the moves of the game. And on move 10, Pillsbury overlooks something. So 1, e4, black plays e5, white plays knight f3, black plays knight c6, white plays knight c3, black plays knight f6, white plays bishop b5, black plays bishop c5. White castles, black castles. White plays knight takes e5. Black plays queen e7. White plays knight takes c6. Black plays d takes c6. White plays bishop d3. Black plays queen e5. White plays h3. Black plays bishop takes h3. White plays g takes h3. What move did black now make? And the game was over in a few moves after black's 10th move. I will read the whole game again. Try to go a little slower this time. You can also always rewind. Okay. 1, e4, e5. 2, knight f3, knight c6. 3, knight c3, knight f6. 4, bishop b5, bishop c5. 5, castles, black castles. 6, knight takes e5, queen e7. 7, knight takes c6, d takes c6. 8, bishop d3, queen e5. 9, h3, bishop takes h3. 10, g takes h3, and then where did black go and end the game? White resigned in three moves. If you see black's next move, you probably see how it follows up. Okay, so that's it for the blindfold puzzles. Again, going to take a one-month sabbatical next month. I've also got some exciting author interviews coming up, and I need to read those books, so I'll be busy grinding away on the interviews, but I will catch you guys in the next book recap in October. Be safe, everyone. Take care. Special thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy, and thanks to those who continue to help spread the word about Perpetual Chess. Positive reviews on podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, glowing comments on YouTube help people discover the show, as does telling a friend or sharing it on social media. Speaking of which, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1, or join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the conversation about the latest interview. Sometimes the guests even weigh into these discussions. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is back in action, so lots of ways to stay engaged, as they say. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those who provide financial support to the show, especially right now with all this COVID craziness going on in the world. Most of all, I want to thank Chessable for sponsoring the show, and to everyone who kicks in via PayPal or the Perpetual Chess Patreon page. I also just put up a little donate directly link on the Perpetual Chess webpage where it says donate. But again, if you're not in a position to donate, I'm happy to have people listening and just enjoying the show. So without further ado, I'd like to give thanks to the people who helped make Perpetual Chess possible. I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities: Chessable.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Apprentice Twitch Channel, Andrew Alhaji, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chris Flanagan, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Harst, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, James Kennedy, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, LelaAnalysis.com for cloud-based Lela engine analysis, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, Peter Zodi, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Stephen Martinez, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, Wayne Beam, and I also would like to thank the following: Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Andy Ryerson, FM Andre Terakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Anita Deer, Barry Hessian, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explain, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dalen Shelton, Dirk Decker, Drake Domingue, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ethan Smith, Ian Mason, I am Elect, Donnie, Ariel, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letarte Lavoie, Frank Tortorice, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schuh, Harish Srinivasan, Jacob Kovach, Jack Perry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, JJ Schnod, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM, Josh Friedel, I am Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopalakrishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Boyovsky, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Miguel Arispide, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Mulajanov, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passan, and Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbeck, Robert Turner, Roy Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Doherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Shane Unger, Stefan Roller, WGM, Tatyev Abrahamian, Tim Brennan, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyrin Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone. I will catch you all next week.
Social Podcast Network.